Sort of building off of the previous question, like kind of how exactly were your conversations with doctors and medical staff prior to getting a proper diagnosis for CRPS? Obviously, you mentioned it was a very short time and you were able to get the diagnosis fairly quickly, but like even for that, when describing the pain that you experienced, how exactly were the conversations that you or your interactions with the medical staff and doctors?
So before getting the diagnosis, for example, I will always remember this when I did the ultrasound and the tech and the doctor said, "Yeah, nothing's wrong, everything is normal." I broke down. I remember my mom being here with me and she was like, "But Zoe, this is good. That means that nothing is wrong." And I just felt like, "No, it's not good, because if nothing is wrong with the test, then that means that I still don't know what I've got. I still don't know what's going on, and I'm in pain." When we got the CRPS diagnosis, I feel like it didn't change anything with the conversations with doctors and nurses and medical personnel, because I didn't really know what it was. Because it's not a known condition, very known condition. It's not a very studied condition. There's not a lot done on it to understand it better. It was extremely hard, the conversations that you could have with any medical staff, because they would not get it and they would not understand what CRPS was. They could understand that you were in pain, but that's the thing that I always say, and that's the thing that I very much think is a huge difference with my POTS, for example. With POTS, obviously, one of their symptoms is having a high heart rate. So when you monitor that heart rate on machines or whatever, they can see a number. For example, they can see, "Oh, your heart rate is 160 right now. It's not good." Pain doesn't have a number. Pain doesn't have any kind of machine that you can measure it with. So the only thing that people can understand is your experience with it. It's saying, "Yeah, I'm in pain." So what they will kind of do is they will do this stupid scale, 1 to 10, how's the pain? That's all they can do, because that's the only thing they can measure on the pain. However, why I say this scale is stupid is I've never said 10, because I always thought that it could get worse, because I could get worse pain than what I've already got. So I was like, "Oh, this is a 9." But when you say it's a 9, they're like, "It can't be a 9, because you're not in that much pain. If it was a 9, if it was a 10, you would not be how you are." I'm like, "Yes, but I am in pain. This is the pain that I have." So even the small scale that we have is not sufficient, because there's no data about it. So it's extremely hard to get your message across and say, "Yes, I am in pain," because you cannot quantify pain. And that's really something that I would be interested in studying and later do research on. Why not? Is start managing to quantify pain from a subjective point of view and actually respect that point of view. Because I think that the just having a scale of 1 to 10 or smiley faces or colors, it's not enough, because saying that it's red will never explain how much pain you're actually in, because they don't understand it. So having that discussion with medical staff, or even sometimes with people that are close to you, because they don't understand how much pain you are, and they can't understand, and they want and I don't want them to be able to understand, because I would not wish that on my worst enemy. But it's a hard conversation. However, as I got older, I managed to advocate for myself more and say that. So basically, when the common conversation I now have with doctors is, "Oh, do you have any other conditions?" I was like, "Yeah, I've got CRPS type 1." And the conversation basically ends here, because I manage it, because I know what it is, because I have a wheelchair or whatever. They basically don't ask me any more questions about this, because I've got it under control. And that's good in the sense that I don't have to keep explaining myself over and over, but it's bad in the sense that they don't seem to know. what it is or how it impacts my daily life, and they just say, oh, okay, you've got COPS. Yes, but I don't just have COPS. I have CRPS, as in I suffer every single day, and it doesn't, and it won't get better. It's very hard to have those conversations with medical staff because they, I think it's more than just medical staff. I think it's also the fact that it's the medical world we live in, because we cannot quantify it, and because we need stuff, we need to be able to quantify things, like, for example, a heart rate or blood pressure. If we can't quantify symptoms, then all of a sudden it's a subjective matter, and they're like, oh, what are we going to do about it? It's very difficult to get your point across medical personnel.
Yeah, no, I understand. There's sort of like frustration that builds up when you tell people that you're in pain, and then they tell you that there's nothing wrong with you. Again, sort of like going back to like my mom's experience with her diagnosis, I know that there was a point where she was so frustrated with being told that they don't know what's wrong with her, she did not want to go see any doctors, because she was kind of like tired and exhausted, and she was like, they're gonna say the same thing, I know what they're gonna say. Every time I go, they tell me that they don't know what's wrong with me, and they ask me to stop using my right hand, which my mom's right-handed, which I cannot do because that's something that I need to live. So like it kind of gets frustrating, and even after a diagnosis, like, to explain people that, like, the extent to which that you're experiencing this pain, like, obviously I can't understand the amount of pain that, like, my mum or any other person with CRPS experiences, but I just know, like, what they tell me about. It gets hard because, like, you still, yes, you're going about your daily life, but you still experience that pain continuously, and that doesn't make any better regardless of whether you're managing it or not. So, like, yeah, it's kind of like frustrating at the same time as how, like, even getting a diagnosis, while it allows you to, like, manage it to a certain extent, it doesn't make the situation a lot better, especially conversations with medical staff. I also wanted to ask, like, you got diagnosed during the pandemic.
Yes.
And obviously, like, medical infrastructure was incredibly overwhelmed during the pandemic. So I kind of wanted to ask as to, like, how did that impact with the process of seeking diagnosis and treatment in your case?
So so our lockdown, I think it was a world lockdown, but in France, the lockdown happened from March to, I want to say, June of 2020. After that, in September, we went back to schools. When it got starting to get worse after, I think, 6 weeks of school, something like that, we did a 50-50 system. So basically it would be 50% in class, 50% online. And that's what happened for me the whole year. So because I got the diagnosis in 2021, we were out of like the midst of the pandemic on the lockdown situations and everything. So I didn't have that much trouble finding doctors. From what I remember, nothing really struck with me about the effect of the pandemic on my condition, because it happened just after the pandemic, at least a huge lockdown that we had. I remember, obviously, like, hospitals, they were a bit crowded and you had to use the mask, like, you had to put a mask on and everything. But that's about the extent of it. I managed to see doctors and be able to live with it, which I'm very, very grateful, because a year before that, I would not have been able to.
You spoke a little bit earlier, a couple of questions ago, about how you've kind of learned to advocate for yourself over the years. So do you think it's because the experiences have stayed the same, so you've had to learn to advocate for yourself, or you have been given the space and the safety to advocate for yourself. How has the advocacy kind of come about?
I think the advocacy came from me growing up with the condition and being, I could advocate for myself. I think until I got out of that hospital, 9 months hospital stay, I couldn't do much to advocate for myself because I couldn't stand up to sometimes my doctors within the hospital that were like, I did not like. And it kind of went on with the years and how I got older and more confident and everything. I think I was never given the space to advocate for myself. I just had to take up the space because if I was not going to do it, I would just be beaten down by the medical system, by doctors, by everybody. So I kind of like had to say, right, this is not true. This is not my experience with it. This is what I'm going to say on this, and you're going to listen to me. And I wish now, if I could go back in time, I really wish I could go back in time to go see myself when I was in that hospital stay. And sometimes I was so beaten down by doctors who didn't seem, all psychologists and everything, who didn't seem to understand what I was going through. They were really helpful, but sometimes they were not really helpful. I think that's the whole point of their therapy. But I wish I could go back in time to go see myself and say, right, you're going to stand up for yourself in these kind of situations, and you're going to be able to say this and this, and you're going to be able to take up space and do something. Because sometimes it felt like the whole world was squashing me, it felt like, because I couldn't advocate for myself, because I was so vulnerable, because I was 15, because I didn't know how to. So now I do it. Now I have no problem. Like, for example, in that A&E visit for my POTS, I was like, I stood up to that doctor and said, right, this is not how this is gonna work. This is not right at all. So it kind of grows with the years. And even I'm guessing it's not because I was a kid. It also happens for people who, I don't know, they're 50, all of a sudden they become chronically ill. Because if they never had any experiences with the chronic illness world before, they have to start advocating for themselves. And if they've never done that before, it can be extremely hard, whatever age you are. So you kind of have to take up the space, and that is extremely difficult for people who do not know how to advocate for themselves because, for many different reasons, they can be scared and everything. I can't always do it. Sometimes I feel like it's so overwhelming that I just say, right, I'm just gonna let this go and I'll vent to my friends, and that's it. But sometimes I feel like, no, this is not right. This is how we're gonna do it, and stuff like that. And I think that the thing that's very complicated, it usually you have to advocate for yourself when you are in flare-ups and when you are in episodes and you're at your most vulnerable, and you have to advocate for yourself. Like, I remember having, for example, a chronic pain episode and having to justify myself, or having to say, right, this is not how we're going to do it because I do not want to do it to people, when I was in my most vulnerable state ever possible. It's like, you do not want to be advocating for yourself in these kind of positions because you want people to understand it, but they don't. So it's important to find people that will understand it and it will advocate for you when you are in those flare-ups. But you, unfortunately, the sad reality is you have to take up the space and you have to start advocating for yourself because nobody else will.
Yeah. So you mentioned again the hospital stay that you were in. It was 9 months, you said, yeah?
Yeah, the clinic, at the when I was 15, yeah.
So I don't, again, this could be differences between UK and France. I'm not sure. But there have been many horror stories that I have heard of people going into these pain clinics for residential stays and having bad experiences. I've also heard it for other clinics that are for like neurological disorders and for rehabilitation. And some of the stories I've heard is that they've been treated incredibly badly, or that you know, just their mental health has gotten increasingly worse. Was that your experience, or was yours more positive? And your mental health, how was it during the center? And like, is it something you would recommend for people to do, basically?
Okay, so it's a very conflicting time, the hospital stay, because there was a lot of positive out of it. Obviously, the huge positive was I was walking again, which we didn't think was possible. And so what happens with these kind of institutions, like, obviously, you've got the doctors. So I had my psychiatrist, and then I have a doctor on the side she was more about the mobility aspect of this. Then you got psychologists, and then you've got sports teachers, but they're special sports teachers. For example, we did wheelchair basketball, which was amazing. I loved it. And then in the day-to-day life, you've got shifts from nurses, and I don't know how they're called. They're not nurses, but they will help in the medical
healthcare assistance is, I think, what we would
say. Yeah, probably that. So we had a shift of 10 of them that will come and go throughout the weekend and the weekends and everything. And they were here on the day-to-day basis. So they would, for example, help us with, I don't know, breakfast and lunch and stuff like that. And we could go to them, or they would sit down in the room and play games, board games with us. Or they would come with us to appointments, or they would school whenever we couldn't go to the school and everything. So they were here on a day-to-day basis, and they would assist on sometimes medical appointments, because they had to then draft up what was being said and everything. So I really loved my time there, because I got to meet a lot of people, and I had a really fun time, honestly, being with this. It was just they were just women, and they were really extremely nice and very good, and I met a lot of people. I don't keep in touch anymore with my friends that I've met, but I know that they're living their best life as much as they can. However, it's not the best experience ever, because you have to remember that you are in a vulnerable situation. You're not here by choice, and you have to stay there until you get better in whatever way they can. And my troubles were more with my psychiatrist that I hated, and my doctor that I also hated, and my psychologist that I also hated. So it's it was more the medical team that I really hated, but the thing is, I hated them in a way because I can stand them, but I also hated them because I did not like what they were doing to me, because they were challenging me psychologically to change, and this is very hard to do. So it's a positive negative experience, because there are some stuff that I wish could have gone differently. But at the same time, if these things went differently, then my life would probably not be the same as it is now, because that was necessary for me to grow up as a human being, as somebody who has COPS and everything. So it is a good time to reflect on. However, it's not the best time, and I would not do it again. Definitely no way. However, it was needed for me to, heal in a certain way, and that made me go on my acceptance journey of a lot of stuff, CRPS wise, psychological wise, and everything. So it wasn't all bad for me. It wasn't all good. I feel like 9 months is a long time for things to go wrong and things to go good. So it was a bit of a mix.
Yeah, I understand that completely, because the stories I've heard, I was once I was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, they wanted to send me to what's it called? The Royal National, I don't know, Orthopaedic Hospital in the UK, which I think is based in London. And they have rehabilitation kind of residential things where you go and stay. But every time I would look it up, I would hear all these negative experiences about it that really made me question whether it was going to be a good idea for me to go. But I suspect at the age of 15, it would have been a very different decision to the age of, 21 that I am now. Final question on this kind of topic is, you already mentioned that quantifying pain is something that kind of needs to be done. Are there any other changes or improvements to the healthcare system, generally France, UK, everywhere in the world, to accommodate people with CRPS?
I'd say the main thing to do is do some more research about it, find out what this disease really is, this condition really is, because it's a lot of people. Because it's a lot of diagnosed people, but it's also a lot of undiagnosed people who go through 10 years, 15 years without a diagnosis, which is extremely difficult. So definitely more research, allocate more time into this kind of condition that can, be very... And More over, like, not even, for example, CLPS, but for example, if I'm thinking fibromyalgia or stuff like that, pain in general needs to be studied more because people suffer from pain every single day. Even healthy people sometimes will be like, oh, I have a bad headache. Why? Why do, like, what I'm really passionate about is understanding why do we have pain signals? What do they mean? And why do, as human beings, we have to live with pain and how pain is seen? Because I feel like today, in today's world, we see as pain is bad. But sometimes pain is good because if you've got good types of pain, it will also tell you, right, you need to rest. You need to sit down for a minute because your body is sending you a signal that you need to rest. Otherwise, it's going to go into a whole other category. It's like, how do we treat pain in general? How do we approach pain within the medical system? I think it's one thing that we can change about it because we could be really looking into improvements. Also, like, for example, with kids, like, I don't know, small kids, they are in pain all the time. They say, oh, my tummy hurts or my head hurts or stuff like that. And we usually dismiss them. But what is the pain they're feeling? Why do they have that pain and everything? We need to approach pain better, I think.
That's actually an incredibly good point, because the other thing I was just thinking about is in young children who maybe don't have the communication skills yet, they can't actually communicate how much pain they're in. And there are multiple conditions in children that can cause extreme amounts of pain, obviously. And if they can't like communicate how much pain they're in, which is why what you're saying about quantifying pain is something that really needs to be done for the whole age range. It's not just for a specific group of people. We need it for everybody, but it's like, what's it called? Universal accommodations, I think, which is things like curb drops, which were originally made because people in wheelchairs like campaigned for it, but curb drops help everybody who, like, people who have like pushchairs and prams, people who carry like a suitcase with them. It's helpful for everybody. And it's similar if we can quantify pain, for CRPS or fibromyalgia or any chronic pain conditions, it's going to help everybody. So why aren't we doing it?
Discussed about this a bit before, but like, how exactly has your life changed now compared to before you were diagnosed with CRPS? As to like some of the things that you used to do before. You also mentioned that you do ballet and with chronic pain conditions. How exactly has that changed for you?
My life completely changed when I had CRPS undiagnosed and then diagnosed. It was just never the same. Like, for example, school-wise, I was now the girl in the wheelchair at my college, so I was like everybody knew who I was. My teachers knew that I was struggling a lot with my day-to-day life. I still consider myself as a ballet dancer, as a dancer. I've been dancing for 12 years. However, when I got CRPS, I couldn't dance for two, I'm gonna say a year and a half. I stopped dancing for a year and a half. I missed on a gala that we had for one of them because I couldn't do it. I was in too much pain to dance. I was not even walking at the time. So I missed on a lot of things. I also missed on or teenagehood, normal teenagehood. Everything became about my health. Everything. I'm not gonna say every conversation and everything because I still had a life, but my life became about my health. And that's a very sad reality because I was stuck in a body that was not working when I wanted to do stuff, when I wanted to be able to go to school, when I wanted to be able to do this, when I wanted to do that and everything. And my life became about my health condition. My life was never the same after CRPS, and it's not the same. I don't think, like, even being at uni, for example, now that I have POTS, which is even worse, but like, I never thought that my uni life was going to be like this. I always, when I envisioned uni, I was like, right, I'm going to be a uni student. I was like, I'm going to be this typical student that just goes with school and life and goes out with friends when they can, when I can have a nice quiet evening. I didn't imagine uni to be the way it is, and that happened because of this major shift of CRBS. So I'm not going to say I regret it, because obviously I don't know another life than the one I've led so far. However, I cannot not acknowledge that my life changed for the better and for the worse, but it was just never the same. And I think that's a reality also. Like, when you live with CRPS, with any chronic conditions, you also have to accept that your life is going to change. Your life will never be the same. And that is, whatever age you are, your life is never going to be the same as it was before. And you miss out on life experiences that you can experience according to your age group. So there's a whole psychological impact when you have a chronic illness that is very much dismissed, because people are like, but yeah, you've got CRPS. Yeah, I've got CRPS, but I also struggle in my everyday life because of CRPS, and that has a huge impact on stuff. So that's the reality. And I think everybody has an experience with this, that your life just changes. And some people accept it, some people don't, and that's okay to also not accept it. I think it's important to say that I accept not accepting it, because you are angry. But yeah, it's a life-changing diagnosis.
Definitely agree with you there, yeah.
Okay, so obviously you got diagnosed as a teenager, and as you mentioned, it's really like challenging dealing with that diagnosis. In terms of more your experience with like school, how exactly did you manage to cope with your school and like alongside process of getting diagnosed and getting your treatment?
So again, when I got the whole CRPS stuff, we were in a 50-50 school-wise, so 50% in class, 50% online. This is also, so in France, we have 3 years of college. The first year doesn't have any exam at the end of it, so it's like kind of we call it a chill year. Like, you just go to class and you just try and get used to college and everything. So that happened for my first year. Like, CRPS happened on my first year. So when I was in, so it was January when I got the CRPS diagnosis, and then I kind of like had to end the year. I managed. It wasn't the best thing ever, but because there were no exams, there were no like deadlines or anything, it kind of didn't matter at all for the schoolwork. I did what I could. Teachers were very understanding. For example, I will always remember this. It was a math class, and I had an exam prior to like a couple of days before. The thing is, I was so drugged up because I was like on 15 pills a day that I had basically put that 2 times 3 equals 15 or something like that. Like, I was completely out of it, and I knew when I gave back the exam, I was like, right, I don't know what happened, because I was so much brain fog and everything from the medication. When the teacher gave me back that paper, he said, so I had a terrible grade on it, and he basically said, listen, I'm not going to put this, I'm not going to count this exam towards your final grade or whatever, I'm not going to input it, I'm just going to say that you were not here for the exam. And I was like, I said, but that's not fair for the students. Who's like, but Zoe, you have a lot going on right now, school isn't your top priority. It's like, no, just like, don't mention it to everybody else and everything, but this is going to say, like, no way am I taking, like, I'm not going to input this data in it, because I know that you can do better. So my teachers were very understanding to understand what was going on with me, and they could really help me. However, so that first year ended, and then into second year, we went back to full-time being in school. So that also really did not help. Plus, at the end of second year, we have a French exam. So it's an oral and written exam in French that we have to take. And also, because I was an international school, I was doing an international baccalaureate, so a Brazilian option. So I also had to ace that. I crashed out after 4 days of second year. I basically had to take a nap into the, we call it, it was a Zen room, so basically a calm room. I had to take a nap, and basically everybody was instructed to leave me alone and take my nap because I was crashed out. That was getting very tricky, because at this point I got called into with my, I think it was both my parents, I got called in the principal's office with my parents to basically talk about me and everything. I will not hide because I hate this person. He basically very kindly and with very polite words told me that I needed to leave the school because I was going to screw up the data because I was not going to succeed with my international baccalaureate. So it will screw up the 100% rate that they have. Basically, I was going to be an annoyance within the numbers. He told me that in very pretty terms, basically, he said, "Oh, you know where you live, they've got a Portuguese section that you could go to and everything." And he wanted to kick me out because I was not happy with, like, they were not going to be happy with the data anymore. When I understood that, I was like, right, this is going to be very difficult because now the principal wants me out of here. The clinic happened 3 months into the second year, so that was really a blessing as well because I got out of this school system and the pressure and everything. So I kind of like exited this at the right time. I don't know what would have happened if the waiting list for that clinic would have been longer because I was like, this is going to be extremely difficult to continue living like this. So in school at the clinic, obviously we continue school, but it was decided that I was going to repeat second year because I could not, with all the medical stuff I had going on, I could not continue on with it. So I was going to repeat second year. However, for the clinic wise, I'm just going to continue with, like, it was French and English to keep in touch with school and basically not like completely lose out of school. So when I got out of the clinic for my 2 years of homeschool, I repeated second year and then did third year and then got my equivalent of A levels. So obviously it was a huge disappointment for me to repeat my second year because I was a year in advance from when I was a kid. I skipped a grade and I basically had to, repeating the year for me meant a lot of failure, so that was really hard on me to, repeat a year because it's not very much in France specifically. When you repeat a year, you're basically a failure, so it was very hard. However, now that I look at it, I could have not gone through school with everything that I had. It was just impossible. I would crash out every single day and not be able to go back to school. So after the whole school thing, when I finished and when I got my A levels, that's why I decided to take a gap year because I wanted a break from the school system, the French one especially. I got a degree and to work as a counselor for overnight camp with kids and school field trips, which then got interrupted with my POTS diagnosis, which is a whole other thing. But for 4 months, I got to a bit live my life and do some work and be underpaid and everything, experience the whole world. But school was extremely difficult with my CLBS.
You sort of, and just to touch on this, but because the clinic, as you mentioned, it's kind of like having the medical rehabilitation alongside the schooling for people who, for kids who need increased medical attention. How exactly was that experience? Like, how did the schooling alongside your physiotherapy and the medical treatment that you need, how exactly was that experience?
So basically, how they work in this clinic is, so the whole school system is based on a national approved school system. However, they work differently in the fact that they work with the medical team to figure out your school plan. So your school comes into your regular timetable. So you've got, for example, it's really funny because I have physio, and then after, oh, I need to go to French. It's like, and it's kind of like normal because it's incorporated into your global timetable. It's like, oh, I've got French, then, oh, I'm going into the swimming pool for some physical therapy. And that was really funny as an outsider to look at. But obviously, when you've got all these kids that are in the same situation, because within the clinic it wasn't only mobility things. So we had, for example, we had our unit where it was mobility and psychological trauma. We had a unit where it was only mobility, so it was kids who had, I don't know, car accidents and stuff like that. We also had units where it was entirely psychological, psychiatric units. We also had units with, for example, eating disorders. So it was a variety of conditions, and the school system was basically here, so they kind of worked with the medical team, they worked with you when they could, and they worked with the national requirements for you to graduate. So it's very good, because it's very interesting to know that you can continue school, because they encourage you to continue school. You don't basically go into this very medical environment. You still have a touch base with normal life and like going to school and being a student. And for example, I had friends who went to school kind of like very much, so they had, for example, they had assessments and they had exams and everything, and so they keep in touch with this real life. And it also helps, because after a while you can't stay in that clinic forever. After this 9 months I was out, so I had to go back into the school world because I was still a minor and I still had to complete school. So it's good that they keep this in touch, because otherwise for 9 months, if you don't have school, it's going to be incredibly hard to go back into the school environment. So I find that it's very interesting. It's not always easy, but it was very easy. For example, I remember sometimes I just could not be bothered to go to the class. So I would have one of the nurses say, oh, I'm just going to excuse you from this class. So they just call up the class, say, hello, Zoe can't come for today. No reason whatsoever. They just say, okay, hang up, and you don't go to class, which was kind of easy. So it was very good. I liked it.
Well, how was sort of the transition from like normal schooling to the clinic to back to like homeschooling and then normal schooling again? Because you also mentioned, like, as you just mentioned, like there would be times that like the nurses would understand and they would excuse you from class, because obviously sometimes you just can't attend because of reasons sometimes you can't fully explain, which normal schooling system wouldn't always be that understanding. So how exactly was the whole transition between like different places for you during that time?
I'd say it wasn't easy, because you have to adapt to every single school system. So going from college to the clinic, it was, the hardest part was accepting that I was going to retake the year, and that after two weeks of it was decided, right, so you're not going to be able to do all of this, so you're going to have to slow down. Then exiting the clinic, going into homeschool world, which is an entire different world. Homeschool is, I do not recommend it to anybody. If you can avoid it, because it is literally the worst school experience that you can have. Because at least on our French, we have the French Institute, that's like, so it's a national school, homeschool institute. You are alone. You are completely and utterly alone. You're basically in a classroom with 3,000 other students. We all have the same main teacher. You only communicate via mails and like emails, sorry, via emails and stuff like that. So you just have to deal with them electronically. You have no face-to-face contact. It's basically you are alone. So I was alone in front of my computer all day, and I was like with my mom who worked from home, and that's it. You don't get to see friends. You don't have time for this. And then you just show up to the exams. You take the exams, and then that's it. So it's an incredibly difficult world. However, I understand how necessary it is for some people, for like me, for example, who cannot go to school full time normally. But coming then to uni from the homeschool world is entirely different again, because you now have to get used to going to class, to seeing people your age, to talking to real human beings and not just a computer typing an email. So it's an entire different world. I actually had a conversation with my tutor about this, how different uni was. And I said to her, I said, I think uni is different for me in a different sense, because I come from a homeschool world from the past, well, technically maybe 3 years, 4 years, because in the clinic it was not homeschool, but it was not normal school either. So I've never had a normal school for 4 years. And then I come to uni and you're thrown back into a normal school setting, and you have to get used to actually going to class. meeting teachers, meeting friends, meeting people, talking, like group projects and everything. It's very difficult to adapt to every single one of them, and to it takes a lot of power to know how to do it every single time and change your whole way, because you will not work the same way you're working when you're homeschooled, then when you're going to uni, then when you're going to clinic, then when you're going into college. So you have to adapt to every single situation, which is extremely hard to do.
Yeah, no, it sounds quite harrowing in a way, I'd say, because like obviously like just the experience of like getting the diagnosis, as you mentioned, is quite a lot on its own. So like, and transitioning between these different systems is also just really hard, because it takes time to get used to these things as well, and you transition between like multiple different things. You mentioned that like you were known as the girl with a wheelchair in the class and stuff like that. So like, how exactly was the experience when you first, like in year one, basically, with not only just teachers, but like even between your like classmates, when you first got diagnosed, and just general experience in school, and how was that different from like before getting your diagnosis?
Well, honestly, like you just said, it's just you were known, I was known as the girl in the wheelchair. I tried my best to use my crutches whenever I could, because I wanted to get out of the chair. However, everybody kind of knew who I was, so I was now dependent on my friends to wheel me around, because obviously it was not an active chair like I have now, and it's not like it was the school chair, so it was very old and rusty and everything, but it did the job. So I got, I needed to be pushed around. I was now dependent on the lift. I was now, yeah, I, even with the crutches and everything, because obviously people will have crutches all the time because, I don't know, they broke their ankle or something. However, me, it was all year round and it was not getting better. So people was like kind of like staring at me. But, you know, I always say this, it's like, I know I do it as well for people because it's a human being to say, but it's like they're staring, but they're pretending they're not staring. So it's like, it's very funny because they're like, they're kind of pretending they're doing something else, but you just know that they're watching you, that they're wondering and questioning and like, oh, what is that and everything. But you do, I do the same thing for other people, which I hate doing, but it's human nature and you can't help it. But I was like, even within my class, I was like, they knew that I was in the wheelchair, that sometimes I'd like have very bad flare-ups. It was more the my teachers and like the educational team that knew more about my stuff, and I usually had my flare-ups with them. But it was like, I appreciate as well that it was a lot for other people, because I think obviously you can't realize this when you're chronically ill, but it has also a huge impact on other people, because they have to deal with your chronic illness. And for example, my COPS episodes are very scary. People can get very panicked by it. So because I start convulsing from pain and then like my whole body shuts down and I can't be touched and I'm screaming in pain and everything, that can be very, very scary. And I appreciate people that will be here with me, but I know how scared they are. But the thing is, in these kind of situations, they kind of have to hide their fear, because if they get scared, and then I panic even more because I can't do anything about it. So it was extremely hard navigating all of this while having CRPS, especially in my year one. And when everything was kind of new to everybody, I didn't know what to say to them. Like, even when I got the CRPS diagnosis, like, you will not know what this is. I don't know what this is. I can't explain it to you. So we just had to go with the flow. I remember, however, I've got a funny anecdote on this. I had a math teacher, so not the same teacher, it was like entering second year before going to the clinic. So the educational team told me that there was going to be a fire alarm while I was in like my math class. I was like, okay, what do I do? Because obviously I can't evacuate. So like, right, okay, so your teacher will stay with you, your teacher will help you, and like you'll go to this these platforms, like balcony thingies outside, like it was a whole thing. I fire alarm went off, the teacher left us, completely just went away, just left. He took his bags and he never came back to school for the rest of the day. He just left. He thought that this was the end of the day. So he left us, and he left me especially on the third floor with the fire alarm, and I was like wandering in the corridors like I don't know what to do. And then the vice principal kind of came in, and she was like, what are you doing in the corridors? Like, my math teacher just abandoned me. It's like, right, you need to stay in these balcony areas, which are not safe by the way, but whatever. He just abandoned me. He's like, what? Because he was very protective of me. So he was like, what? That's not true. He went and commented and yelled at the principal saying, this is not possible. She can't leave it. So it was like all these kind of things, because people like don't realize, for example, that in a fire alarm, you can't just walk down three flights of stairs. You have to have a plan B. And that teacher obviously didn't know what he was doing. So it's like now that I laugh about it a lot when I think about it, and I laugh about it with my family and everything, but in the moment it's like very traumatic. So like if the building was on fire right now, I would not survive. So it's like it's funny, but at the same time it's not funny, because this should not be happening at all. But in educational settings, that's the reality of it, because they don't realize the impact of your disability.
Okay, so two questions. Was he not told that he was supposed to leave with you when the fire alarm started?
I don't know. This teacher was very not here all the time. He had no idea what was going on in life. Like, honestly, he was completely lost, and he had no idea who I was and what I needed. I kept telling him, I was like, listen, you need to come with me. You need to stay with me. I need help and everything. He's like, okay. He just left.
Okay, it kind of sorry, it's comically grim in a way, because like it kind of brings me to one of my other questions. Like, did like at least after that incident, did the school come up with a procedure of how to evacuate students with wheelchair? Because like even if you were the only person with wheelchair in the school, after you leave there might be another person with wheelchair, or there might be another person on wheelchair at any point. So like, did the school come up with a plan how to evacuate people with wheelchair after that incident? And also, like, did the school take any other measures to accommodate to your needs in just daily
That is a good
schooling?
point. Yeah, that's a very good point, because now that I think of it, I was like, this was not normal. But I don't think they do. They did when that educational guy. Okay. It's like I keep calling them educational, but they're basically people. I don't know what they're called in English, but they're basically people that will help you, that are here. For example, they're here for like the lunch area, the recess time, and like they make sure that everything's going smoothly in the corridors. They deal with administrative work and everything. They're not teachers, they're not like high principal stuff, and so I keep calling them educational people, but whatever. So this, when he yelled at the principal, she basically told him, she's like, yes, it's not normal, but you know, he's new to the school. I'm like, what? This is no excuse. Even if you're new to the school, you're not new to being a human being. You're 40 years old. You know, you don't leave a young girl struggling to get down the stairs. So I don't think the school did anything to rectify their mistake or to do anything about it. Again, now, for example, being at uni, I do it when they mess up, because I email people and I complain and everything, because I'm older and I know how to do it. When I was a kid, when I was younger, I didn't know how to do it. I could barely stand up for myself. So I was like, no way am I saying anything to anybody. But however, this was a very dangerous situation that could have escalated into, yeah, danger a lot.
Yeah, no, it's quite weird that like if they have students, regardless of whether they have students, that so again, like someone could be in a wheelchair, or someone could be disabled, or receive a disability diagnosis at any point in their life. So like it wouldn't make sense to like not it does not make sense to not have those accommodations in place, especially in cases of like fire safety evacuations. You also mentioned like being on a cocktail of meds. How exactly did that affect your ability to participate in studies and also like social life at school?
I was basically out of it. I was so drugged up that I couldn't. I was a zombie, walking zombie, because I was on 15 pills a day. I could not eat, but I needed to eat a little bit to take my naproxen, which is a type of ibuprofen. So I obviously, like, for example, this math incident where I can do basic math, I can think anymore. I was starving, I was nauseous, I couldn't do anything, which is why the doctor at the pain clinic basically made that decision to stop the medication quite quickly. So I wasn't on this cocktail for long. I think it was maybe 2, 3 weeks. So it's okay. But for example, going back on medication with my POTS, so I'm currently on propranolol, when that got introduced in June, the medication was very, it's a heavy medication as well because it's a beta blocker. So obviously, like, it lowers heart rates and everything, but obviously you get extremely tired because it can lower blood pressure. They've got all these symptoms as well, so they don't help. What's like, this is really a common misconception with medication is that, oh, they help. Yes, but they do have a cost. They do have severe side effects on many stuff. So having this cocktail of 15 pills a day was extremely difficult. It's also difficult when there's no results because it was not helping my chronic pain. It was just a cocktail of medication, basically. That's why we decided to stop it. But it had a huge impact, and I'm grateful that it only lasted 3 weeks and not more, because I think I was a walking zombie, honestly. I didn't even know my name at this point. So it was very difficult.
You mentioned that you took a gap year after your schooling for like 4 months. You worked. How was that experience like, getting out of the schooling system after so long and finally like being on your own for a while before you got back into education again?
I loved it. So the whole reason I took a gap year was because I knew I was coming to the UK for my studies, for my university studies. In France, when you take a gap year, it's extremely difficult. So this is the very bad school system, in French school system. So basically, there's a whole thing. So you know the UCAS thing that you do, you apply for universities in the UK. You have a different system, a similar one, but very not well done in France. When you want to take a gap year, you have to. So when you apply for this, it's your last year of college. You apply for, it's called Parcoursup, just so anybody out there hears it. And basically, you apply for it for universities. However, if you want to have high success of actually getting into university, it has to be a university that's near where you live. Otherwise, you get into an entire different application system. So you will, like, maybe you have they open up 2% to other students coming from other parts of the country. Completely stupid. So basically, you get into this, and if you take a gap year, or if you don't go through that process, when you go through it again a year later, you will literally go after every single student that is in their last year of college. So if you want to go to university taking a gap year, you have to justify it to this UCAS system, saying, I'm taking a gap year, this is how it's going to help me academically. They have to approve it. And once they approve it, you can then take your gap year. And that means that when you come back a year later, you don't go after every single student to get a spot at uni, which is stupid. So the only reason I took the gap year was because I knew I was coming to the UK, and that basically I deferred entry and were like, oh yeah, fine, take a gap year, have fun. I was like, awesome. So I took my gap year, and it was amazing, an amazing experience, because I got to work a little bit, not much obviously, because I got and then got POTS and was bed rested, bed bound to for 6 months. But for the small time, I really, really liked it because it was, I was on my own, basically. I was doing stuff, like, if I worked with kids, which I really like. I got to meet people outside of the hospital stay or the school settings and everything. So it was kind of a whole different experience. And it also got me to this point where I now know the value of money, for example, which until you work, you don't really know the value of money. It's very different. It's very difficult. So I know the value of money. I know the value of hard work. I know the value of being underpaid because I was severely underpaid. I know all of this. And this has like been from that experience, which I have loved and recommend it. My sister is going to do the same, taking a gap year, because I think that it gives you an entire different life experience that you would not get if you don't take a gap year, which is fine for somebody that wants to continue their studies. But however, taking a gap year in France is incredibly not well seen. For example, to everybody I said, oh, I'm taking a gap year, it's like, but you, I don't think that's a good idea because you're going to struggle getting back into your studies. It's going to be difficult, you know, I don't think this is a good idea for you. It's actually the best thing that can happen. And I know that everybody I talk to who've taken gap years say that it was an incredible good thing. And it was good to have a break from the school settings with my health as well. So obviously I had new challenges with my health. I'm not going to say it completely disappeared, but it was good to have new challenges beside, oh, I need 25% extra time, you know, in exams. It was like, oh, I need this for accommodating me if I want to work with you or stuff like that. So that was really nice.
I mean, yeah, no, the idea that like the system sort of like pushes people who take gap year down, it sort of like systematically tries to make sure that people who take a gap year have lower rate at success. And obviously there are multiple reasons as to why people take gap year. Slightly similar, like coming from India, growing up there, gap years are incredibly uncommon. It's not as systematic in terms of like pushing people down for gap years, but it's also like very societally looked down upon, and like you need to have like a really good reason as to why you're taking gap year. Like it needs to be good for your academics and stuff like that, which I feel like it does. Like even with me, I didn't take a gap year, but I have been continuously in education since I was 2 years old. So I haven't had like any of that break, and it's been very difficult in terms of having depression and anxiety. I can imagine like it would be much harder dealing with that entirely continuous shift of a continuous sort of like flow of education system while also having chronic disability. It
yeah.
would be incredibly hard dealing with it. So it doesn't make sense. And it's kind of like the systematic discrimination of people who might need to take gap year for multiple reasons, specifically for people dealing with chronic disabilities. And it's quite disappointing.
In an opposite kind of respect, I applied for, so started having all my health issues at the age of around 17. So it was very close to me, obviously, going to university. I initially applied to university to take a gap year. So I deferred my entry on my UCAS application because I thought there is no way I'm ready to go to university right now, kind of when I was in the application process. I'm also the sort of person who never really enjoyed going on trips away from my parents on the overnight school trips. I was incredibly anxious about those well before like any of my, I guess, health issues kind of started. So I was already nervous about going to uni, which I think kind of came into my reasonings for deferring a year. But when I got round to actually thinking about it, and it was coming closer and closer to the time that I was going to go to uni, and I'd gone on the offer holder days and I'd looked around Sussex, I was like, maybe I do want to go this year. But I was still kind of up in the air about it because my parents were like, maybe it's a good idea to take that gap year to try and, like, you know, understand your conditions and everything. And I was like, yeah, maybe. I also didn't think I was at a place where, you know, having seizures and going to uni is quite a difficult thing because it can be incredibly dangerous and things. But then like I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to go to uni this year. And I don't necessarily regret that decision because I don't think I'd be in the place I am today if I had taken a gap year. Because I hated the idea of going away from home so much, I think I just needed to throw myself into it and not have a year to think about it for me personally. But I do think that taking a gap year would have allowed me to get, you know, assistance and care straight away instead of waiting for 4 years, because I've only just this year decided to get care. I would have probably understood my own body better than I did during that first year, and I would have understood how to advocate and like ask for my own accommodations when I needed it, which is exactly, you know, what you're saying of you learn so much about yourself and about being an adult in that gap year, Zoe, that I think I missed out on, and I had to learn it during my first year, which was quite difficult. So I don't necessarily regret it, but I do sometimes just sit back and think, in a hypothetical situation, how different would my life have been if I had taken that gap year?
So in terms of, like, obviously we covered your schooling and your gap year, so like, how has it, obviously you just got into university this year, but how has the experience of being a university student been so far?
Right. I will just preface this saying that in France, accessibility is not as advanced as it is in the UK. So when I got to England, I was in a honeymoon phase, I call it, because I was like, wow, this is amazing. We do not have that in France. So before I go into how it's not perfect and it's far from perfect, I just want to say that compared to France, the UK is very advanced on it, and that is very something that the country can be proud of. That being said, it can always evolve into a lot of better situations. So when I registered with disability on for university, I got all of the accommodations for exams, which is awesome. So I got like 25% extra time, smaller room, blah, 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 all this stuff. However, I think the university doesn't really quite understand that basically you don't only need support for your exams. You need support the entire term, the entire year, the entire course of your undergraduate, master's and PhD, whatever. Because exams, it's only 5% of your time. It's only this. You only need your accommodations for your exam. That's the only time you need them. The rest of the time, you have to struggle. So there's like what, 12 weeks of term? You have to struggle for 12 weeks with basically no help whatsoever, except from disability advice that sometimes will help whenever they can. And they're really good people, and they will try to help. But obviously, they're very limited with what the university can offer. So that being said, is you have to accommodate the students that need it for these 12 weeks of term, and then the 12 weeks of second term, etc., etc. You can't just say, oh yes, we accommodate students for exams. That's not enough, because exams are only 5% of your time within your studies. So what I feel like at university when I got here, after the honeymoon phase kind of like went away, I feel like university only did... They started the job of making this campus very accessible, but they stopped halfway through it and they just never got back into it. I'm guessing the excuse, I call that an excuse, that they will say is basically budget and cut funds and etc. I think this is an excuse, because if they started it, then that means that they had the money to carry on. And I will always compare that they're building West Slope, which I'm guessing is a very, very big budget. However, they can't put automatic doors that work on campus. So this is a bit like contradictory and stuff. So yeah, they really, like, my feeling is they only did half the job necessary. And for example, in my accommodation, so I live in East Slope. I'm in an accessible room that was built on the second floor And the only way I can get down to campus or down my accommodation is with the lift. So you have to rely on technology, and unfortunately, technology breaks down. That has been the case multiple times. So I, when technology breaks down because you're dependent on that technology because it's not built, it wasn't built on the ground floor, you basically have to rely on it. And if it fails, you're stuck. And that's the reality. And even if it's just for 7-8 hours, it's still 7 or 8 hours where you have to depend on multiple people, or you just can't get out. And it is the worst feeling. Like, even if I had nothing planned for the day, now that I know that I'm trapped, I need to get out. I need to have some fresh air because I feel like I'm going crazy and insane. So I will never understand the decision to not have any ground floors room, accessible ground floor rooms in East Lope. I think the building is 3 years old, something like that. I think East Lope was built quite recently. So I don't understand. I hope they don't make the same mistake for West Lope, for example.
I was going to say, there are ground floor rooms in Camber, which is where I stayed, in Camber and East Lope. But Canberra is all the way at the top of the campus, and it's really hard to get to. So, like, they have, like, ground floor houses, it's really difficult.
This is the other issue I find with East Slope specifically, is that, I think for anyone it's an issue, is because you have to go at least up one hill. If not, you have to go through the lift through Fulton or the lift through the student centre. And I remember, Zoe, you saying a couple of times that the lift or the access to Fulton stopped after a specific time, which means you also can't get down that way. Now, I obviously head to the Trafford Centre a lot and the Clinical Imaging Centre for when I was working over the summer, and also for my master's, and randomly when I go up there for team meetings. And I have to use that route as well, and then obviously go further up the hill. But I've done it a couple of times where I've tried to go up the hill from the bottom because Fulton lift just was taking a while or seemed to be out of order. And in my electric chair, my power chair, it is tricky enough as it is. So for wheelchair users who might not have don't have a power assist in any sort of way, getting up that hill, if the lift isn't working in either of those two places, it doesn't seem incredibly accessible. Like, there should be a contingency plan for if the lifts stop working so that people can still get back to their flats, because I know for a fact in my manual chair, I would not be able to make it up there. Up that hill if the lift stopped working.
That's the thing. The problem is the uni thinks that they put alternative accessible routes, but they're not accessible because like, for example, when Fulton lift broke down, well, it didn't break down, but like they had to put it out of order for a couple of hours. They could tell me, like, people could tell me, oh, you need to go all the way back to the student centre and then back. I'm like, I'm in a manual wheelchair. I do not, for now, have any power add-ons. So this is impossible for me. It's not an alternative. And even if it was, it's not, because you're adding 10 minutes to your extra route. So it's not an accessible route anymore. It's just something that you have, so you can say, yeah, you got alternative routes, which are not. It's not inaccessible, just as going through the bins is not an accessible route. Like, I'm sorry, but when I have to go through the bins to get to my destination, I do not, because able-bodied students, they don't have to go through the bins to go to their destination. Or rooms that are said to be accessible, but you have to go through three different buildings before you can access the room. It's not an accessible room. So I think the whole definition of accessibility needs to be re-seen and revised and re-looked at, because it's not accessible routes. They don't exist. It's just you've got one route and that's it. So
yeah, I think it's really interesting that you're saying that the whole, I guess, what the uni defines as being accessible needs to be kind of revised, because it's incredibly true. I was thinking about all the accessibility issues around campus, and I think it's an unfortunate reality that there are always going to be accessibility issues with some place, because regardless of whether they've gotten a disabled person to, I guess, oversee it and say where they think accessible things need to be, because there is such a wide variation of accommodations that are necessary, you do sometimes have two accommodations that are conflicting. So it's not always going to be 100% accessible. But I think the university should be making more of an effort to, when disabled students raise problems, to come up with a solution or work with the students to come up with that solution to make it more accessible for them. And that is, I guess, what Access Sussex does. But the uni needs to also take accountability for the issues that the campus has.
I think what is really tricky is obviously it's not perfect and it will never be perfect. And we understand that. I don't want campus to be perfect because it simply cannot be. If it was perfect, the whole campus needs to be rebuilt differently. I personally, I can't speak for everybody out there, but I don't expect the university to make a perfect job. I just want them to make a decent job, for example, fixing my lift when it's not working and stop the lift from breaking down all the time. It's simple things that turn into a drastic and dramatic situation because nobody is doing what they need to do. And just like you said, Emily, they don't work with disabled students. For example, I have told people multiple times that I want to be sitting in these discussions about stuff that involve me because I am the first impacted by this situation that is happening. So I want to be to sit on these decisions. I want to be talking with the people responsible for this, and I want them to know how it is impacting me and not just talking via email because they don't know who I am. They've never seen my face. They've never seen my wheelchair. So it's like it's very difficult. So it's like it's very hard because people always say, yeah, but it can't be perfect. I don't want it to be perfect. I just want it to be accessible. I just want it to change. Like, for example, the whole campaign that Access Sussex is doing for putting a lift in for the library, that should have been done years ago. And it's not. It's just being built in right now, and we're not even sure about the timeline. Hopefully, it can be done before the end of the year for this academic year, but we're not sure because anything can happen at this point. It's like, so it's these kind of things that you can tell and you can see that it was not made and it was not built in collaboration with disabled students, wheelchair users, chronically ill people, and everything. It's like, so we just want them to listen to us to be able to do something because otherwise it escalates quite quickly to dramatic things that can be not good for the university and it's not good for us as well because we have to put in all this extra effort. We're already dealing with so many chronic illnesses and very hard lives. I don't want to be dealing with administrative work because the university is not doing their part of the job, but that's the reality.
I think also it's not only the university should give, well, no, yes, the university should give us a seat at the table and listen to what we're saying regarding accessibility and then put in plans to fix that. But it's also while those plans are taking effect, we might need contingency plans. So when the lift's not working, for example, and they might know it's going to be out for several days, offering emergency accommodation alongside actually fixing the problems. And I think when you have the backing and support of groups, for example, Access Sussex, of course, but also the disability team, a lot more things get done. But it's incredibly nerve-wracking to say to the university, this isn't accessible when you're just one individual person. And that's why things like Access Sussex and the Disabled Student Society and having the DSO and DAP officers are incredibly useful.
The next question is like, obviously, like school or college and university is different, but like dealing with educational institutes in both France and UK, how has the experience been different between both the countries in terms of how different institutions accommodate to your needs or understand at least of the willingness to understand your needs, how has it differed?
So, like I said, the UK is very much advanced compared to France. because France doesn't really know what accessibility is. So they're getting there. I'm not saying that nothing is being done and everything, but my mom, who works closely with families who have disabled children who are disabled themselves and everything, they struggle every day. And just like I struggle every day. And for example, it is not where it's supposed to be. We have a hard understanding of, as well in France, of invisible disability as well, which in the UK is much more accepted. For example, on the simple fact that when I took the bus, there was like a poster that says not every disability is visible. So like leave your spot, like leave your seat to somebody who needs it if they ask for it and everything. So the UK is way more advanced than this. And like I said, obviously, like it's also different because I think if I were to be in educational settings today and being like having this different France versus UK system, I'd be able to come up with many more differences. But because I was like 15 when I had to deal with all of this, I like the information didn't even register my brain at this point. I just remember like traumatic things like trying to kick me out of school. However, my best friend, who is on her third year of university in France, she has severe endometriosis, so she deals a lot with accessibility and everything. It's a nightmare. Like, I'm not gonna say it's like a nightmare. So, for example, in the university, they in here, for example, they understand that you can't submit every single exam on time. So you've got ECK claims for exceptional circumstances, claim for non-submission, late submission, and then everything. In France, you don't have that, basically. In France, you have to justify that you're disabled with like doctor's notes and everything. So for them to make accommodation for you, otherwise they kick you out. They kick you out of school. The huge difference as well that you need to know is obviously in the UK, you pay to be here. Through student loans or whatever, and a UK citizen will pay 9K per year. In France, school is mostly free. You just pay tuition fees that are maybe 200 euros, so that would be £150 or something. And that's it. So basically, in France, they can kick you out of school if you're not doing well because you're not paying a huge sum of money to be here. In the UK, from what I've understood, is they will not kick you out of school. They will maybe let you take repeat the year or some stuff like that, or change your degree because you're paying 9K a year. Like obviously they can't kick somebody else unless it's like for a huge what's the word, legal grounds and everything, but they're not going to kick you out because you're paying 9K a year. So that's a huge difference. Now in a French system, you have to do well even with your disabilities, and they're not going to accommodate you. My best friend, she's not a wheelchair user, but she struggles to walk sometime, and so she has lifts, but they don't always work. She has classes, but they don't always accommodate her needs, or she has to work really hard and she doesn't have any help and everything. So France is very much behind on all of these aspects, which I'm grateful that at Sussex University, or even I'm guessing universities in the UK, they're quite advanced on this, and they put things in place to help you. Obviously, you can always do better, but it's way better than what I have back in my home country.
Yeah, I'm assuming also like the situation that you mentioned that like because students pay a lot more in the UK, the university cannot legally kick you out. It sort of brings me back to like my previous point as well. Like I'm assuming it would be a lot more complicated for an international disabled student to navigate the system if they have to repeat a year because as international students, we are put on visa restrictions and we need to, like, there are conditions oftentimes that if we have to repeat a year, we have to either extend our stay, which takes a lot of money, or there are chances that you can get kicked out of the country. So it's a very complicated system in general to navigate. In terms of things that can be improved, like what kind of things that you that might be helpful, or changes that might need to be made to the education system to accommodate people with disabilities, specifically people with CRPS.
So, specifically for CRPS, because obviously I know it's very hard. You can't accommodate every single chronic illness because there's so much variety of everything. So you can do a global accommodation for everybody, and then you've got specific care. So in like the CRPS aspect, to give maybe people just a little bit more information on what CRPS is on a day-to-day life. It's like, for example, you first of all, you need to understand what sets off the pain, the condition, what it is in itself and everything. For example, one thing that happens when I'm at Tussex in my wheelchair, uneven pavements that have like lots of vibration are extremely painful because you're very sensitive to those vibrations. I deal badly with buses, cars and everything, so being on uneven pavement, so for example, with somebody accommodating somebody with CRPS, you want to like a smooth pavements with no, like I call them because I don't know the word in English, but it's basically this feeling that it's vibrating, and so I have to lift up my legs so I can't feel as much. So for example, yeah, just dealing with the pavement, trying to make it smooth some everywhere and everything. Like obviously pain isn't the only thing about CRPS. Sure, you have extreme fatigue, which is different from being tired. Just want to put that out. So you have extreme fatigue, you've got body weakness and everything, so you can't deal with every single thing. For example, you can't open heavy doors because you don't have the muscles to open heavy doors, or it will hurt your arms and everything, so you put in automatic doors when they work. So stuff like that. I also, something that I want to say is people with CRPS or any single chronic condition or pain condition, we get really good at masking the pain. We get extremely, extremely good. It comes with years of practice. Basically, you can never tell we're suffering. That's a mask that we have to put in place because it protects ourselves. Because if we're constantly showing that we're in pain, first of all the attention goes on you, even if you don't want it. People are like, oh, you're in pain, or talking about it all the time and you don't want to. So you put this mask on. So people have to understand that we are always in pain. We are always suffering. We just put this mask and we put this smile on our face to pretend. Sometimes the mask kind of falls off a little bit, so people get to see it. For example, I just sometimes will break down when I'm meeting with tutors or something because they ask me a delicate question and I kind of didn't know what to do about it. So we get really good masking the pain. So it's really, you have to accommodate people with CRPS knowing that they're hiding the pain and knowing when they're not, and when you can be vulnerable with them and when you can talk about it with them. Something that you can always also improve is like communication, because I can talk for hours about CRPS, what I need, what the condition is, I can tell you everything about it, but you have to ask the questions, because I will not put this on you. I will not say, oh, do you know what CRPS is? Because that's not a catchphrase. And, you know, this is not small talk. This is deep talk. But, like, ask the questions and I will answer. Even about POTS, I don't mind explaining to everybody what POTS is, because then people understand what I'm going through and they can help me whenever I need. So communication is a huge part as well of understanding CRPS, and just communicate. Like, I will gladly have a teacher come up to me and say, oh, I read your support learning plan. I know you've got CRPS. Can I know anything more about it? How can I support you in anything? And I will gladly sit with them for an hour talking about it, because they can help me, and then they get interested in the subject and they can help other students as well. So communication is a huge improvement that can be done in educational settings.
As you mentioned, like, communication is obviously important. The part where you mentioned about the pavements, the small dots on some of the pavements that are there,
yeah,
which make it hard. I think those dots are mainly there for people who are blind and to navigate spaces. But yeah, even with like places that have uneven pavements, which, like, I know there are parts of like the Library Square in Sussex that have uneven pavements or like broken pavements,
yeah,
which, like, I have stepped into them multiple times, but I can imagine those are just plain dangerous for people, wheelchair users.